Hello and welcome to Program Notes for your North Carolina Symphony, an exclusive production of the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. I'll be reading the program notes for all of the Classical Music Series concerts by the North Carolina Symphony for the remainder of the 2018 season. The program notes I'm reading today are for the performance by the North Carolina Symphony on Friday and Saturday, May 18th and 19th at 8 p.m. in Maymandy Concert Hall, Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts in Raleigh. This concert will be conducted by Grant Llewellyn. The program on this performance will include the following. The symphony opens the performance with Ver Clarte Nocta, Transfigured Night, Opus 4, the 1943 revision by Arnold Schoenberg. And then following the intermission, the symphony returns to the stage to perform Ein Heldenleben, A Hero's Life, Opus 40 by Richard Strauss. Now I'll begin reading the symphony notes. The first work to be performed by the North Carolina Symphony is Ver Clarte Nocte, The Transfigured Night, Opus 4 by Arnold Schoenberg. Schoenberg was born September 13, 1874 in Vienna, and he died July 13, 1951 in Los Angeles. This work was composed in 1899, orchestrated in 1917. The first performance was March 18, 1902, at the Vienna Musikverein. The first performance of orchestral version was December 24, 1924, in Newcastle upon Tyne. Edward Clark was the conductor. Now, here is the overview. Arnold Schoenberg, one of the most influential composers of the early 20th century, was the son of a shoe salesman. Although he had violin lessons as a child, he was virtually self-taught as a composer. His early compositions from around the turn of the century were lush, romantic, and tonal, as exemplified in his first string quartet, early songs, the symphonic poem Pelias and Melisande, and the string sextet Ver Clarte Nocte, composed in 1899. Now, he gradually developed a style that continually challenged the limits of tonality and triadic harmony, sharing his work and ideas with his more formally educated friends. But his appeal to the conservative Viennese audiences was always limited. Working in a bank to put bread on the table, he nevertheless was admired and encouraged by the intellectual and musical luminaries of his time, including Gustav Mahler, and gradually established a career as a composition teacher. As a Jew, he was forced to flee Germany under the Nazis, eventually settling in Los Angeles. By 1906, Schoenberg had found the constraints of traditional tonality artificial and confining. He developed a compositional language, originally called atonal, that precludes tonal relationships, as well as traditional melodic and harmonic progressions that might even suggest a tonal center. He spent the next 15 years developing and codifying the new musical language. The result was the 12-tone system, or serialism, an extension of the late Romantic chromaticism, where for each composition all 12 semitones of the octave are used in a predetermined order. The order can be transposed, inverted, or written in retrograde or retrograde inversion, but has to be maintained. Encouraged by such composers as Mahler and Richard Strauss, who nevertheless refrained from incorporating his new ideas into their own works, Schoenberg pursued this path, but generally remained unappreciated by the public. Now here's what to listen for. Composed in 1899, Ver Clarte Nocte is almost Wagnerian, recalling especially Tristan and Isolde, which stretch the limits of tonality and the sexual morality of the 1860s. The title Ver Clarte Nocte comes from an 1896 poem by Richard Damiel, 1863 to 1920, that celebrates new life both literally and figuratively. Its form, and that of Schoenberg's music, is an ABACA structure. Section A recurs as a refrain in which a narrator describes a couple walking outside at night. In Section B, the woman informs her companion that she is pregnant by another man. And in Section C, the man answers with exceptional understanding, compassion, and acceptance. The transfiguring warmth shared between the man and woman defies the taboos of society to create a unity for the unborn child. Schoenberg did not consider the piece to be true program music. In 1950, he commented, "It does not illustrate any action or drama, but was restricted to portray nature and express human feelings. In other words, it offers the possibility to be appreciated as pure music." In 1917, Schoenberg transcribed the work for string orchestra, and the instrumentation for this work is for strings. Following the intermission, the North Carolina Symphony returns to the stage to perform Ein Heldenleben, A Hero's Life, Opus 40 by Richard Strauss. Strauss was born June 11, 1864 in Munich, and he died September 8, 1949 in Garmisch-Partenkirchen in Germany. The work was composed in 1898, the first performance March 3, 1899 in Frankfurt, Frankfurter Opern und Museum Orchestra, conducted by the composer himself. Now, here is the overview. Franz Liszt had coined the term symphonic poem in 1854 for compositions accompanied by an extra musical program, usually a narrative that the audience was supposed to read before listening to the music. Telling a story via an array of instrumental themes without text was a new iteration of the leitmotifs of Wagner's music dramas, motifs representing characters, objects, and ideas that provided a running instrumental commentary on the poetry. Although Berlioz, Mendelssohn, Tchaikovsky, and other 19th-century romantics did not all use Liszt's term, symphonic poems became a standard medium for them. But the form reached its apex with Richard Strauss. His attempts to render a specific text in pure music are far more detailed than Liszt's. "I want to be able to describe a teaspoon musically," Strauss is said to have commented. Oddly, he shied away from explaining his tone poems in detail, preferring that the audience make up their own story. Starting in 1888, he produced a string of tone poems that brought him international recognition. The general optimistic atmosphere at the end of the 19th century created hubris that infected artists and scientists alike. Famed physicist Lord William Kelvin is said to have stated in a 1900 speech, "There is nothing new to be discovered in physics now. All that remains is more and more precise measurement." Strauss was not immune. By 1898, he was at the height of fame and power, both as a conductor and a composer. He was about to start the prestigious job as conductor of the Berlin Opera, and his tone poems were lauded throughout Europe and America. Now here's what to listen for. Strauss expressed his self-confidence in Ein Heldenleben, the last of his tone poems, before turning his attention primarily to opera. The work consists of six parts, or titled chapters, played without pause, describing the life of an unspecified hero. Certainly, there are autobiographical aspects of the tone poem, but there are others that bear no relationship whatsoever to the composer's life and must be regarded in a more generalized or philosophical light. The six parts are, number one, the hero, a lengthy theme extending nearly three octaves and lasting half a minute describes the hero in grandiose ascending arpeggios. Second, the critics. Strauss satirizes his critics with three nitpicking, interlocking themes in the upper winds. It is not clear whether he means specific critics or simply Philistines who do not understand his music. The third part, the courtship. Strauss's wife, Pauline de Anna, was the model here. A notoriously strong-willed woman, she is portrayed by the orchestra's concertmaster in one of the most demanding orchestral solos in the repertory. The string of cadenzas is a shameless seduction, but the hero isn't snared so easily. The first few notes of his theme lurks down in the lower winds, brass and strings. His gradually increasing interest is symbolized by adding more and more notes of the theme. But once she's got him, it's all harps and strings. When the French music critic Romain Rolland asked Strauss about this rather negative musical portrait, Strauss replied, "It's my wife I wanted to show. She is very complex, very feminine, a little perverse, a little coquettish, never like herself, and every minute different from how she was a moment before." This, incidentally, is the longest section of the tone poem. Part number four, The Hero's Battlefield. An ostinato of trumpet flourishes calls the hero to war. But is this a real war or a war of musical polemics? Strauss himself was never in the military, and the hero is certainly not battling those niggling woodwinds here. The section ends with the companion's theme and a full repeat of the hero theme, suggesting the hero achieves victory with his wife's support. From here on, the hero takes on the more generic quality of an idealized everyman. Part number five, The Hero's Works for Peace. In this section, Strauss runs through many quotes from all of the previous major works, interspersed with motivic fragments from the hero theme. Scholars have been guessing for decades what Strauss meant by the title of this section. One possibility is that it brings together all of the subjects of his oeuvre to date as a single composite hero, as flawed as Macbeth, lascivious as Don Juan, or foolish as Don Quixote. In other words, human. And part number six, The Hero's Retreat from the World and Inner Peace. The section begins with confusion and dissonance that resolves into a long English horn solo, riffing on one of the hero motifs and sounding partly like a low-pitched bird call and Swiss Alpenhorn. Everything seems settled in the broad melody that follows, but a sharply dissonant call from a raucously muted trumpets and brief reprise in the background of the critics signal an alarm, and the mood changes completely with a funereal timpani. This time the solo violin, the companion, returns, exuding warmth and solace. Before the final cadence, the violin joins in a duet with the first horn. The ascending trumpet arpeggio that closes the piece, a truncated allusion to "Also sprach Starstrusha," suggests that the hero has reached inner peace by subsuming his ego into philosophical contemplation. This work is made for the following instruments here: piccolo, three flutes, four oboes, English horn, two clarinets, E-flat clarinet, bass clarinet, three bassoons, contrabassoon, eight horns, five trumpets, three trombones, tuba, tenor tuba, timpani, percussion, two harps, and strings. These program notes were written and copyrighted in 2018 by Joseph and Elizabeth Kahn. You've been listening to Program Notes for your North Carolina Symphony, an exclusive production of the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'll be reading all of the program notes from the classical music series of the North Carolina Symphony for the remainder of the 2018 season. This program is available on demand as a podcast on the day before each concert series and will remain available for the remainder of the concert season. I'm George Douglas. Thank you for joining me today. We sincerely hope that listening to Symphony Notes will enhance your enjoyment of your North Carolina Symphony. Goodbye until next season.